From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on January 23, 2012, in the United States Supreme Court. Justice Antonin Scalia authored the majority opinion on Jones v. United States. Antoine Jones owned a nightclub in Washington, D.C., and law enforcement suspected he was involved in the drug trade. So the government placed a GPS tracking device on the suspected drug dealer's car and followed the vehicle's movements for almost a month. Now, prosecutors argued that this was just fine. The defendant, after all, wouldn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy on public roads. But Justice Scalia found it to be a violation of the prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. Scalia wrote that at the time of the drafting of the Constitution, there was a particular concern for government trespassing on persons, houses, papers, and effects. And Scalia emphasized that the Fourth Amendment must provide, at a minimum, the level of protection as it did when it was adopted. One case, one example, but a good look at the legacy of Justice Scalia, who was a proud and unabashed originalist, someone who viewed the law through the lens of the original intent of the people who wrote it. And yes, this puts Scalia in opposition with justices who tend to view the Constitution as a living document. This hour, my two guests have, I suspect, quite different views on Scalia's legacy in regards to original intent and liberty. And that will make it for, I think, a productive discussion. Let me welcome them now. Joe Waldorf is here. He's a former prosecutor, now in private practice, focusing on state and federal criminal defense. And it's great to have you, Joe. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Jim Bowers is back here, the chair of the Department of Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. And Professor Bowers, nice to have you back as well.
It's been such a long time.
It's been a few days, but Jim contacted me over the weekend and said, look, I know we just talked last week about separate issues, but this is a particular passion. So we are going to talk about original intent, et cetera, but I thought we ought to just open the hour listening to the words of Antonin Scalia himself. This is from an interview with CBS 60 Minutes and Leslie Stahl talking about his views on what original intent is and isn't. And so you'll hear some of the back and forth there. And I believe this is from about 6 or 7 years ago, CBS News 60 Minutes. Let's listen to that first cut there.
It is an enduring constitution that I want to defend.
But what you're saying is let's try to figure out the mindset of people back 200 years ago, right?
Well, it isn't the mindset. It's what did the words mean to the people who ratified the Bill of Rights or who ratified the Constitution?
As opposed to what people today think it means.
As opposed to what people today would like.
But you do admit that values change. We do adapt. We move.
That's fine. And so do laws change. Because values change, legislatures abolish the death penalty, permit same-sex marriage if they want, abolish laws against homosexual conduct. That's how the change in a society occurs. Society doesn't change through a constitution.
That's Justice Scalia talking to 60 Minutes. I'm going to start with Joe. Does that line up with where your mind is on the law?
Yeah, I kept nodding my head throughout listening to that in its entirety. I think that he's right on the money, that his view and that theory is one of which, you know, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are meant to impede quick and simple and easy change swayed by public opinion and the masses. It's meant to really guard against that sort of easy willy-nilly change, and he, however personally he may feel on gay marriage, on any of these hot button issues, it's the legislature. It's the legislative democratic process by which that change is to be effected.
But and on that point, we have one other set of comments from Justice Scalia from that same 60 Minutes interview on the Constitution and its meaning to impede change, not spark easy change. This is Justice Scalia.
These are people that don't understand what my interpretive philosophy is. I'm not saying no progress. I'm saying we should progress democratically.
You think there ought to be a right to abortion? No problem. The Constitution says nothing about it. Create it the way most rights are created in a democratic society. Pass a law. And that law, unlike a constitutional right to abortion created by a court, can compromise. It can see. Oh, I was going to say it can split the baby. I should not use it. The Constitution is not meant to facilitate change. It is meant to impede change, to make it difficult to change.
Okay, so a couple things there. That was a little bit of a... That was Scalia, I think, trolling pro-choice is a little bit, but at the same time, Joe, he's making the point that it should be difficult to change and it should not be up to the court necessarily. That's what a legislature's for, an elective body, yes?
Absolutely, that's right. That encapsulates that vision, that philosophy. And I'd also note that that speech, if I recall, was from an Oxford Student Union
speech. It sure was.
Speech. And I think that goes to something about the Scalia would go on road shows, and in his writings, he took great care to explain his position, why he believed it. And again, he's not opposed to laws to this nature, however personally he may be, but there's ways to go about it that are not in the Bill of Rights and Constitution.
Now, before I let Professor Bowers take the floor here to offer a different take, one other point here, because what's interesting is the more you look at Antonin Scalia's career, the more you will find occasional surprises. I think people forget he defended the right to burn the American flag as much as he found it aberrant, for example. And he goes back to he falls back on simply saying, look, it's not about what I believe about the action. It's about the legality and the constitutionality. So it is interesting to look over his career that way. But his good friend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has said this is why she thinks Scalia is wrong about original intent. She said to Leslie Stahl in that same interview, Leslie, original intent said you and I wouldn't even be voting. We wouldn't be granted the same rights. That was the original intent, that African Americans wouldn't have the same rights. So you can't just fall back on original intent as if it's perfection, because clearly it was noble but needed updating. And that's why she believes in more of a living document. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, it's not so much disagreeing. I think that even if you were to look at Scalia, he said at some point that he was almost a faint-hearted originalist. He's not a Thomas. Thomas will, to whatever bitter end the original intent takes him, and you see that in his writings. I think Scalia was not necessarily on a suicide pact with originalism. I think he had common sense about him. But again, I think at all costs he would try and tether whatever opinion or judicial outcome to the text, to the history. So again, I do believe in that as a founded basis. I do not think that the person in the robes should be the one deciding what's a fundamental right, what's not. And to the extent it's a living constitution, that theory would allow for that. That's not really something I would sign on for.
Professor Bowers.
Are we allowed to go into the second hour?
We're going to need some time with this. Are you about to filibuster? We have an express rule, no filibustering here.
And no more sports analogies.
Yes, I am the sole justice on this court when it comes to the guest behavior. Go ahead.
Okay. Joe, you're a little right. And I don't mean right of the political spectrum either. Okay, here's the thing with originalism. As practiced and articulated by Justice Scalia, it produces a constitution that is static. And he's actually wrong that the constitution is to impede the way he means it.
To impede change?
Right. The constitution is meant to impede government, not liberty. And one of the problems with the originalism that Scalia advocates is that it produces a static, text-only driven notion of liberty, which is actually diametrically opposed to the notion of liberty that the framers had.
Give me an example.
Well, the framers practiced a political philosophy, or of the vast majority and the leading ones, that was heavily rooted in a natural law understanding of rights and liberty that stemmed predominantly from the teaching of John Locke and some of the other classical liberals. And in that regard, liberty is extremely expansive. Locke himself writes that you cannot articulate the full range of liberty that people have, because in large part, liberty relates to the notion of happiness. And while my own students will look at me a little strangely, this liberty can range from what you decide to wear on any given day to your religion, to your political beliefs, that liberty is vastly expansive, but yet Scalia's form of originalism would contract that largely to what was expressly stated in the text. Well, if you go that far, there's actually no liberty stated in the text, because even the Bill of Rights are only structural limits on government, and they do not place any positive right in front of you. The second part of that, I'm sorry, is, and this is where Joe and I will disagree a little bit, since Scalia does not recognize that rights come from nature and pre-exist, he can make the erroneous assumption that, no, a legislature extends rights. That's a very classical positivist understanding of law, that law and rights only come from the sovereign. Well, if that's the case, then the sovereign can also take those rights. Therefore, none of us have liberty. The only way our system works is if we understand what the framers understood when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, is that rights pre-exist, and the purpose of a constitution does not grant rights, rather it secures rights and it limits government in the ability to limit and abridge those rights.
All right, so things like same-sex marriage, abortion, Scalia has said, you want those, you can have those. That's what legislatures are for. Jim, your argument is that's such a narrow view, that originalism is so narrow that it threatens those rights that should be inherent.
Yes, just like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's view is too expansive, because her approach would not anchor rights anywhere, where the natural law proponent, you know, like myself, those who practice kind of a classical law, classical liberalism, originalism, says, no, you have to have parameters, but you find those parameters within the limits of natural law that the framers embrace. So in effect, both Scalia, both originalism as practiced by Scalia and the living constitution practiced by Ginsburg, people like Bill Brennan and others, are for the most part not grounded correctly in the Constitution or the original theories that influenced the Constitution.
Jim loves just saying they're all wrong.
Hang a second, though. In fairness, and again, I'm not trying to filibuster.
That's okay.
Scalia, the opening that you read, when he voted correctly and constitutionally correctly in the Fourth Amendment case,
Jones v. United States,
that yeah. type of intent, that was clearly articulating an intent. So his static form of originalism can be right on occasion, but it can be wrong on many other occasions. A classic one that you see popping up in this campaign now is, help me here, you do the appellate stuff, the new Kello versus New London, which was about eminent domain, where the liberal majority of the court decided that economic development was the equivalent to public use that the Constitution talks about. And Scalia just wrote a blistering dissent, and he was correct on that, because public use had a very narrow definition, because it was about protecting property.
You say writes a blistering dissent. That's nothing new. And I will say, having gone back, and especially I contacted Joe and Jim, and I said, you know, where ought I be studying? Because I can't, in the course of the time that's passed since Scalia's death, I can't study all of the landmark cases he's been involved with. But when you read his writing, and he said, and he has said many times, that he wrote the way he did because, first of all, he's a good writer. He likes doing it. He likes to antagonize a little bit. He said so. But he also knew that if he wrote a little more theatrically, that it might actually be read by the public, which is a good thing. So I appreciate that about going back and reading his work. Now, Joe, what I want to let you do is respond to some of what you just heard from Jim. We'll get to some phone calls from listeners coming up here. And I do also want to eventually touch on the fact that Joe, as a former prosecutor but now working in defense— you know, I know you hold Scalia in high regard because of some of the work that he's done. In fact, he told Slate.com, or I should say Slate.com quoted him, and this is one of Scalia's famous quotes. He said, quote, "I ought to be the darling of the criminal defense bar. I have defended criminal defendants' rights because they're there in the original Constitution to a greater degree than most judges have. So we'll get to that. I see you nodding.
But yeah.
But go ahead and respond to some of what you just heard from Jim.
Well, I'd like to take his class. He'd be a wonder. He's a wonderful professor, it sounds like. I think for me, the beauty of Justice Scalia and his interpretation, his judicial skills, is that, as we've already heard, wherever his personal beliefs may have fallen on a particular issue before the court, that was not going to dictate the result. He was not going to sway in the wind based on his own personal beliefs. On the flag burning, you know, there's a quote attributed to him that, you know, do you think he liked some scrubby-haired, sandal flip-flop-wearing hippie burning the flag? That's not something that he liked. But I went back and listened to the oral argument, and he was ripping apart the state prosecutor for asserting these arguments. You know, again, he wasn't going to allow his personal beliefs to really interfere with the text and what the right result is, not what he thinks the right result should be. But as to the readability, not only of his written opinions, as a law student, and I've talked to a bunch of my colleagues, when you're in law school and you come across a Scalia opinion, you're buckling your seatbelt, you're excited because it's one of the opinions that you'll find highly readable, whether you like it or hate it. And it's a page turner.
Whether you think it's great or pure applesauce,
right? Exactly.
Jiggery pokery.
Exactly. His ability to turn a phrase is remarkable. He put a lot of work into it, and you also see that in the oral arguments. People are prepared for the oral arguments. They know that Scalia. He kind of ushered in the hot bench era, where people appearing before Justice Scalia took the bench were probably in for a snooze fest where they were just going to state their case for 10, 15 minutes. But upon his entry on the bench, you know, they were going to be probed. They were going to be pressed. They were going to be put to the test by Justice Scalia. So both in oral argument and in his writing, the written and spoken word were just – he's pretty unmatched as far as the court has ever seen.
Justice Ginsburg has said that his – dissents to her majority opinions, and he would deliver them before she'd finally published, which he did as a courtesy to her because he knew she wouldn't like it, but he knew that it would make her writing stronger. I always appreciate a kind of friend who's like a Scalia, who makes me absolutely prepared and can't, you know, I like a friend who doesn't let you get away with a weak or sort of a half-considered argument, and that certainly was Scalia. But before I get back to Jim and get to your phone calls, Joe, Chris writes to us on Twitter and objects to some of what Scalia's done. He says, Scalia's interpretation of the Constitution and emphasis on legislative supremacy is prone to harden a tyranny of the majority. The framers specifically argue that the Constitution is meant to counter such tyranny. What do you think, Joe?
I suppose I don't disagree with that in some respects, that you know, again, the Constitution, I think you've seen from Scalia and others, elections have consequences. And certainly, you know, it may well lead to intractable and just, you know, trench warfare or legislative battles. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, I disagree that if people have problem with the legislators, then they need to vote those people out. And I think Scalia, his position was the Constitution's there to protect those articulated fundamental rights and responsibilities. For everything else, you, the voter, need to determine who your elected representatives will be and will they carry out the wishes as you deem appropriate. So I see the writer's point. But I disagree that his philosophy somehow promotes that. It's we, the voter, that need to turn the eye on ourselves.
Jim?
Well, okay. This is where we're going to agree to disagree. First off, his prior comments, actually how you characterize Scalia, I would agree 100% with. There's no way that anyone can take away from his legacy as an intellectual leader on the court. But as I said to you on the phone before, intellectual leaders can also be wrong.
Of all stripes.
Of all stripes.
There's no question about that. But he is wonderful to read.
And I agree.
Wonderful to read.
And this is why I respect him in the when his form of originalism results in what is also a constitutionally correct argument. My problems with both of Scalia and we'll just stay with his friend Ginsburg is that, again, Scalia's approach is too static. Her approach is too expansive. To go, for example, to the gentleman who texted, the gentleman is correct in the sense that, one, anytime you bring a democratic or a democracy argument to the Constitution, that in of itself underscores a failure to understand the real intent of the framers. Democracy is never, ever mentioned, nor did the notion of democracy, other than to reject it, ever enter into the framers' discussion. There is a purpose for why they created us as a republic, as opposed to even a representative democracy, even if you look at the original structure with the states, basically the Electoral College choosing the president, states choosing the Senate. Their focus was not the promotion of democracy. Their focus was the promotion of liberty. And so the reason for the independent judiciary was in large part to do exactly what the person who texted said, and that was to prevent tyranny of the majority, because unlike a Scalia who might say this, you can't necessarily unelect those people. So this gets back
why
to
why can't you unelect? You're not talking about...
Because if there is a majority that's tyrannizing, they probably have the majority support to do that tyranny.
Okay.
So the minority loses. This is why it goes back to understanding that the core philosophical goal of the framers of the Constitution and their purpose for the government was to secure liberty. That they were the government's responsibility, which this government from either the right or the left is simply not doing, was to work for the public good as the public good was defined as to secure liberty. And then to operate within its limited parameters in ways so it could not violate the very thing that it was there to secure. And this is why anytime you ground a notion of rights in positivism and in a notion of a majority, you basically undermine the ability to ever protect that liberty.
All right, Jim.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I think this.
You have touched a passion.
I think this is a productive discussion. And Chris on Twitter follows up to say, yeah. Legislatures can get things wrong. Jim Crow was enacted by democratically elected legislatures, and that's part of someone like Chris's concern, that under a Scalia construction, under this originalism,
yes.
It leaves too much room for legislatures to tyrannize a majority to get things what we would call wrong.
And again, if I may, and please cut me off, because unlike the stuff we do on politics, this stuff really does drive me. You probably have tapped into my real passion.
Okay. It's okay.
You know, I don't want it to sound like I'm filibustering at all. Part of what Chris is picking up on the text really stems back also to the progressive era. It was in the progressive era and the era of Justice Holmes that we all at once discovered the idea of social engineering through law. And if there was a quote-unquote perceived need that legislators and the community ought to be able to legislate socially in a way to coerce appropriate behavior. And you don't see this discussion of deferring to democratic legislators, to legislative supremacy, until the progressive and Holmesian era. In fact, as great as Holmes is seen much like a Scalia, and Scalia will rise to that level. If you look at Holmes, he was anti-liberty right to the day he died because he believed in this deference to social engineering and the will of the legislature.
I believe he also had an opinion I believe, in a forced sterilization, yes, thing, saying two generations or three generations of imbeciles is enough.
There you go.
So there's that.
That's a great example of what we're just talking about.
All right, but Jesse on Twitter wants to push back against what some of Jim is saying, because Jesse is saying that look, Scalia himself cared about the common people. Scalia was a populist. He felt the court was elite, that the legislature better represented the people than the court itself. And that is reflected, Jesse's point reflected on what some of Scalia's comments before his passing were regarding what the next choices and appointments ought to be. He wants to see fewer elites like himself from the Ivy League. He wants to see more of middle America. He'd like to see an evangelical. I think there's five Catholics on the court, for example. He wants to see more of a balance. I don't never say anything about atheists. I don't know how Scalia would have felt about that. But Jesse's saying, look, he thought the legislature better represented the people, Jim, not a body of nine not very diverse court members.
When it comes to policy, clearly. When it comes to liberty, not necessarily so. These things aren't in opposition to one another. They're supposed to be in balance with each other. A legislature who has worked within its appropriate parameters of its authority and in the process has, even if it touches a liberty, has touched on it in the most minute way as possible, probably has done fine. But what too many people forget, and I think Scalia is guilty of promoting this false dichotomy between the court's role to secure and protect liberty from the elected branches. There's a reason it's an anti-democratic court in the sense of elected. It was designed for that very purpose, to insulate and to isolate the justices from those same kind of political pressures that a legislature would have. So these aren't meant to be either or. They're meant to work in balance. Like people on the radio can see what I'm doing with my hand, right?
Creating a balance. No, I see. Look, I'm late for a break, and what we're going to do
Sorry
next
about
is
that.
Joe Waldorf's here, who's a former prosecutor and now in private practice focusing on state and federal criminal defense, was agreeing with the quote that I read earlier from Scalia saying he ought to be the darling of the criminal defense bar for some of his work. So after this short break, Joe's going to tell us more about how he and some of his colleagues view Scalia's legacy, especially as it relates to criminal defendants, for example. And we'll get some of your phone calls as well. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Scalia's legacy continues next. Coming up in our second hour, 11 things every city needs in order to be successful. It's a new list from journalist James Fallows after he traveled the country observing cities up close. And we're going to ask how Rochester does when you look at this list from our public leaders, public-private partnerships, local patriots, even craft breweries. How does Rochester fare? Help us analyze that list next hour.
Meet Kareem Salim El Amin of Baltimore.
Went to prison when I was 18 in 1971. I served 42 years, 3 months, and 3 days, 2013.
And William Gardner.
I served 46 years and 5 months. Got locked up when I was 16.
Why did they and dozens of other Maryland lifers get out of prison, and how are they handling their freedom? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joe's here, a currently practicing attorney. Jim Bowers is here, chair of the Department of Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. Agreeing at times, disagreeing at times, but before I get to your phone calls for the rest of the hour, I do want Joe to touch on where his line of work intercedes with Scalia's legacy, which is quite often. How do you view Scalia's legacy when it comes to criminal defense?
It's incredible. As a DA, as a defense attorney, I am constantly coming across opinions that I'm seeking to advance an issue for a client, and Scalia is inevitably involved somewhere.
Examples
would be Crawford versus Washington. It really radically altered the landscape of everyone's understanding of the Sixth Amendment's right to confrontation. What had happened in Crawford basically involved a defendant and his wife. Defendant stabs victim. The defendant's wife at trial does not testify, and yet at trial they are allowed to use her statements at the trial against the defendant. Scalia issues a decision saying that such testimony cannot come in. Testimonial evidence not subjected to cross-examination from the founding days all the way back to England, no good. And that you need – the Sixth Amendment says you have to be able to confront your accusers in trial, put them in the crucible of cross-examination. And so, again, starting from Crawford, and it just – a whole line of decisions sprung forth from that. And it really was a watershed – changing moment for the Sixth Amendment understanding on confrontation. That was Scalia. With respect to the Fourth Amendment and the home, there was no greater defender of the privileged, cherished status of one's home, privacy, and law enforcement using technology to invade that. So, for example, he struck down he classified a search where law enforcement utilized a thermal imaging device to examine the outside of someone's home, and it reflected high heat signatures indicating a marijuana growing operation. He found that to be a search, and the case got tossed out, sent back. So also, he was dissenting, and it's interesting. I want to actually get the lineup of the roster. He dissented in Maryland versus King, and it was Scalia writing for the dissent along with Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Again, not the usual lineup you would think of with Scalia's siding on, but that was a case where he was dissenting from a Maryland law allowing for arrestees to be compelled to provide a DNA sample, which would then be searched to identify cold case hits, whether they could solve those cases. And so, again, a blistering Scalia-like dissent that just really chastised the majority for allowing this practice.
Saying you can't compel people to give DNA samples.
Correct. His quote was, "The proud men who wrote the Charter of our liberties would not have been so eager to open their mouths for royal inspection." When it comes to criminal, the criminal justice cases before the court, when it comes to search and seizure, Sixth Amendment, very few. As a criminal defense attorney, I love it. It's fantastic.
It comes across your line of work, it sounds like, all the time.
Every day.
And I'm curious to know, and this is impossible. Joe's not here to speak for Antonin Scalia. No one is. But how fascinating watching the case where the government wants to compel Apple to release, to kind of dig into the phones of the San Bernardino terrorists. And Apple is saying that sets a very dangerous precedent, and we don't want to do it. And that may look unpopular on Apple's side. I have no idea. I cannot speak for Scalia. Do you suspect he would agree with the company in that case, Joe?
I would tend to think he would. I think he would view this as being one of the most pernicious uses of law enforcement possible, where essentially, I think if I were to think like him, perhaps it would be like going back, to force a company to, make a duplicate key to get into a storage safe. Any number of things he would probably draw on, and I think he would find a lot of examples that would correlate to this action and find it not to be okay. This is a real problem.
Jim?
Well, actually, first, I'm enjoying this part of the discussion quite a bit because it at several levels. One, just to see and understand the true application of his original intent, which is really what he's getting at. And what I also like about this is these cases dealing with the rights of the accused is a good example where Scalia's original intent was valid. I would never challenge him on that. The issue for me is because he restricted his intent to what was expressly stated, is that he didn't let his original intent take him where it needed to go. and it's a broader form of intent. I would, again, not being a lawyer, but just following his philosophy in terms of Apple, I would concur. And you can even see a natural law argument here. Government cannot force another individual to violate another individual's property, nor can they use one individual at the expense of another.
Yeah, it would be a fascinating argument. And you're seeing that argument play out, because some are saying, well, look, the owners of the phones are deceased and are known to have committed murder and terrorist acts. They forfeited their rights. But at what point do you start applying that to living people or suspected terrorists, et cetera?
Well, they are actually doing that. I don't have the case site offhand, but there are situations, and what the government's using in this case is, I believe it's like the All Writs Act or something to that effect, where basically a district court judge is using this All Writs Act to authorize the government to do what they're doing, to force Apple to basically create something to get into this phone. But there have been situations where district court judges have granted government applications under the All Writs Act to compel an individual to provide a passcode. So, for example, if the terrorist here in San Bernardino had lived, this All Writs Act, there are prior cases which have supported a government application to compel them to provide this code. I don't know if this case has trickled all the way up to the circuits or the Supreme Court, but the application of the All Writs Act to getting into stuff that the government can't get into is a big issue, real big. And going back to Scalia, I think he'd have a problem with it.
It sounds like, and we go to the phones now because they're lit up and we'll stay there for the rest of the hour. Joe, it sounds like what Scalia, at least part of his legacy, is making the government, law enforcement, police work better and fairer and more effective than simply using any means they want to go after people and then retroactively justifying it. Scalia was not okay with that.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't meant to be easy. It's not meant to make law enforcement work easier. It's not meant to make obtaining convictions easier. In the Crawford cases, it basically, if we can simply put forth, documentary evidence that someone's guilty, why the need for a trial, right? So
let me get to the phones, and Simeon is first up. Go ahead, Simeon.
Yes, thank you. In terms of Justice Scalia's originalist approach to interpreting the Constitution, where he said that the task of the judges was to sort of try to the best that they could to divine the intent of the framers with respect to a particular issue and apply that intention to the case, it should be pointed out that virtually all the leading constitutional historians have a tremendous problem with that approach, because they say that fundamentally the framers of the Constitution they disagreed among themselves in many ways as to the meaning of the provisions of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They also understood that they were designing a document that was meant to endure over time. And as part and parcel of that, it required a certain flexibility and the ability to give future generations the ability to understand its provisions in light of changing circumstances and needs. Joseph Ellis, Bernard Bailyn, Gordon Wood, leading constitutional historians, said that the originalist intent approach was a misnomer and it was a misreading of constitutional history. And the other thing that I would say is that in many, many cases, I think Justice Scalia, even if he wanted to use that paradigm of the originalist approach, he got it wrong. I would venture to say that Thomas Jefferson and other framers of the Constitution would be rolling in their grave to understand a 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court coming from the town of Greece, which allowed sectarian prayer to open meetings of the town of Greece and other town meetings. And that is done invoking the originalist concept, the originalist theory of understanding the Constitution. They believed mightily and profoundly in the wall of separation. So I think that there were some very real profound problems inherent in the originalist approach.
All right, Simeon, thanks for the phone call. In regards to the Town of Greece decision, you might remember it's a couple of summers ago now, but it was the town opening meetings with prayer, almost always a Christian prayer. A Jewish person and an atheist challenged that. And I think some of the language involved did lead some Jim Bowers to think, tyranny of the majority here. Some of the justices were almost flippant in saying, well, big deal, this has been going on for decades.
Well, I wear way too many hats. There are some times when you can't necessarily understand a decision based upon the jurisprudence of the majority, and this may be one of them, in that justices bring to their decision a full realm of influences. You would hope most of those are filtered there through their jurisprudence, but we have to remember that someone like Scalia, Roberts, Thomas, and also the Democrats, they also have a great deal of political experience in one way or the other, or they would not be sitting on that high seat. And so my guess is, in part, the Greece decision was decided as much on conservative politics as it was on conservative original intent. There does seem to be some lack of clarity in certain aspects of the dissent. Religion. I have a feeling if Rehnquist would have been still presiding on the court, perhaps Greece would have gone a separate differently, because Rehnquist, as an accommodationist, his argument was that the intent wasn't to be anti-religion, but to accommodate all religions. And that would allow for a prayer, but then understanding that it could not be exclusively Christian, that there would have to be a recognition
sure.
of others.
All right. So, Joe, you want to respond to some of what you heard from Simeon as well?
Yeah. With respect to this idea that adherence to originalism somehow can't comprehend or decide cases in the modern era, I think the examples that we've talked about previously undercut that idea that it's some sort of an inflexible philosophy, the examples being the GPS case that you started the program off with. The founders had no idea what GPS was,
sure.
but yet Justice Scalia is able to hearken back to the theories, the moving forces, and apply that to a pro-defendant, what's really a pro-Fourth Amendment decision. So to say that it's some inflexible doctrine that he's simply unable to comprehend the modern era, I think it's not accurate. Numerous cases show that he's able to look back through history, pull those principles forward, and apply them in many cases, I think, appropriately. But, you know, a lot of people disagree with that.
Right, Professor?
Real quick, because Joe just got me to think of something. When Scalia was writing a ruling in those cases, what he was allowing his originalism to do was to expand, to adapt to the current times, as opposed to a literalist like William Howard Taft in the Olmsted case, the first electronic surveillance case, where the wiretap was outside the house. So Taft, for that majority, said, well, the framers meant a direct invasion of the house. Or the phrasing is in the Constitution is safe in the person's property, home. Since the wiretap is on the outside, there's no invasion. So where Taft, well, I don't think anybody would call him an originalist, but as a point of comparison, was close to what we might call a literal originalist, where there was a willingness in Scalia to take the intent and apply it.
All right, let me get back to the phones, and this is Roy in Rochester. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes. Well, I'm still sorting my thoughts out a little bit.
So am I.
What I was thinking is a very early decision, I think, by Scalia. I think it was a cross-burning case, a youth only named by his initials, and whether or not they could enhance punishments.
Right.
Hate crimes material.
Yeah, this.
And the other thing is, I think over his career, I think he grew in unsightly ways, like a bad plant. And all I can think of is get over it.
Roy, thank you for the phone call. Jim, you were going to jump in on the crossbar.
Well, and again, I'm terrible with cases. I'm surprised I even remembered Olmsted. But Yes, this was a case coming out of Wisconsin or Minnesota where a cross was burned on an African-American family's lawn, and Scalia basically said, and this will sound horrible to some people, is it was protected. It was a form of speech. I mean, help me out here.
Yeah, but hate crimes would be a designation that Justice Scalia probably wouldn't recognize. It's a crime's a crime. What I can also say, though, is the idea of enhancing penalties. He's also his Sixth Amendment jurisprudence really altered the federal guidelines landscape as well. For a long time, people would be convicted of a federal offense, and then after, at sentencing, a judge would find these aggravating enhancing factors, which would really elevate the actual sentencing. So I think Justice Scalia was very careful on enhancing punishments beyond which couldn't be supported in either the legislation or the text.
Yeah, because he understood that, I like what you said, a crime is a crime. The motive of the crime, it can't be punished.
Sometimes can't be determined.
And can't be determined.
With specificity.
Right. And that's, in effect, what that case was saying.
Now, Mary in Rochester, we're moving along on time here. She wants to talk about three strikes for criminals. And go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything from your panel yet about Scalia's stance on the three strikes statute. And I talked yesterday with somebody who is doing a life sentence under that statute, and he was sorry to say, and you know, but understandably relieved that Scalia is gone from the court
because of three strikes specifically.
Yes. And the I wonder if any of the panelists are familiar with case law where Scalia stood in the way of the three strikes being abolished, or at least not applied.
Mary, I don't know specifically. Joe Waldorf?
I'll have to confess ignorance on Scalia's view or any case law cites as to the three strikes rules. But what I can say is one area where Justice Scalia was not a favorite son of defendants would be in habeas corpus, post-conviction proceedings, death penalty stays, stays of execution that would come to his office at the midnight hour. Those wouldn't often find favor with Justice Scalia. The habeas corpus cases essentially would be a situation where, almost like Jim's talking about, where his adherence to, well, where's the fundamental right? Where can we tether this to the Constitution? He would find problems with claims of actual innocence by way of habeas post-conviction challenges. So Justice Scalia was not a fan to criminal defendants who've been convicted and are doing habeas corpus or other post-challenge convictions. That was an area where he'd probably affirm convictions. He was not a fan to these collateral challenges, I could say.
All right, we got about 2 minutes left, so closing arguments here. I'm going to start with you, Joe. You're someone who has a lot of regard for Justice Scalia and his legacy. And when we ask to sum up legacy, I mean, you don't agree with every piece of writing Scalia published. I don't think anybody does, right? That's what makes people humans. What is the core of his legacy to you, though, if you had to sum it up?
I think the core of his legacy is just this incredible body of written material that he's provided for future generations of lawyers and the public that will shift the direction of the law one way or the other. Whether you like him, you'll seek to advance those positions. If not, you'll be seeking to counter it. So just his written legacy is going to live on forever, as far as I'm concerned.
It's hard to argue that. If you're the kind of person who appreciates the kind of arguments you tend to get from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you should appreciate Scalia, because she has said he made her arguments better just by being an intellectual who was as forceful as he was.
And I'm disappointed that I won't be able to afford probably a Justice Scalia bobblehead doll. They do have those, and the prices are probably through the roof on eBay right now, so I'm disappointed.
Jim Bowers.
I would concur, but I would add that he will also should be and will be remembered as a lightning rod for both the right and the left, neither of which fully understood him.
Yeah, I think that's interestingly said. And you know, I'll just close with this. I was, you know, one of many who read his work on same-sex marriage, and when you read Anthony Kennedy on same-sex marriage, and then you read Roberts, you get two very different views of how that law should be applied, and then you see Scalia come in just throwing pejoratives, et cetera. But what he did say to Leslie Stahl and probably said to the very end was, I will criticize your ideas mercilessly, but I will respect you as a person. Doesn't mean I have to have any respect for your ideas. And he said often he didn't, but he loved Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He loved his opponents. And that is something about Antonin Scalia, whether I like his overall legacy or not, I appreciate that about him, because we need to be better in this society at criticizing ideas. Ideas are not worthy of respect. They're worthy of examination. People are worthy of respect. And I do think Scalia meant that when he said it. So our thanks to Joel Waldorf. Great talking to you here, Joe.
Thanks, Evan.
And if they want to find more of you, I know you guys are online. Where's your group? Where do they find you?
JoeWaldorf.com, Twitter at Joe Waldorf.
Nice conversation. I appreciate you taking the time. Jim Bowers, long time no see. Nice to see you. He's headed back out to St. John Fisher and the students there. Thanks for taking the time to have the conversation.
Glad to be here.
All right, a short break and much more Connections next.